Hello, this is Christopher Holmes. Welcome back for another edition of Zero Point Radio. Today I'm in beautiful New Zealand. I was invited to New Zealand about over a month ago by the Theosophical Society of New Zealand to attend a seminar on science and theosophy. And since then, I've been invited to do a tour of New Zealand, sharing my insights and modern interpretation of Blavatsky's work. And at the moment, I'm in Napier, and today I head to Wellington, and then across to the South Island, where I have three additional talks over the next week. If you go to my website at www.zeropoint.ca, and you go to the event schedule, you can see where I'm speaking and at what times over the next week. This is Zero Point Radio, and Zero Point is actually a term which I have taken from the writings of H.P. Blavatsky, particularly from The Secret Doctrine. Now, The Secret Doctrine was published in 1888, and it depicts the origin or creation of the universe according to the ancient wisdom teachings. The Secret Doctrine is a remarkable and unusual book, one of the most intractable theses of modern times. It is so incredibly complex. It's been described by Manly Hall as undoubtedly the magnus opus of the literature of the modern world. Because of its complexity, the meanings of it have largely been obscured. And in my own work, I'm arguing that the newest ideas in modern physics and cosmology allow us to provide a new interpretation and understanding of Blavatsky's classic masterpiece. Particularly importantly, I've extracted the concepts of zero points from the work of Blavatsky, and I've been able to relate these to the newest ideas in modern physics and understanding of the quantum vacuum and new concepts of the holographic paradigm in physics. At one point in The Secret Doctrine, Madame Blavatsky writes, "Material points without extension are Leibniz's monads, and at the same time, the materials out of which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies." Now, this is a very complex quote, but essentially, the concept is that all living beings have a zero-point center, and it is through the dynamics of these zero-point centers that the higher-dimensional intelligences, divine intelligences, and spiritual intelligences spin their magic to bring life into the body of a living organism. So the zero points, in a way, are portals through which higher dimensional influences are brought down to bring life into living beings. Now, in modern physics, the idea of zero point energies has emerged in physics. And the concept of zero points is related to what in physics is called the uncertainty principle. Now, according to the uncertainty principle in physics, we cannot know the position and the momentum of a particle simultaneously. The more closely we measure one attribute, the more the value of the other becomes undefined. So if you try to measure the position of a particle infinitely precisely, then the uncertainty about its momentum or energetic level becomes completely undefined. It passes to infinity. Heisenberg compared it to the man and woman in a little weather house, that if it's sunny, the man comes out, and if it's raining, the woman comes out. But you can never have the man and woman out at the same time. So you cannot know the position and momentum of a particle simultaneously. Now, if you had understood Blavatsky's teaching about zero points in 1888, you would actually have predicted the emergence of the uncertainty principle. And I'll try to explain this. See, Blavatsky explains that ultimately everything in creation is part of one undivided unity. That there is a this is a fundamental dogma, she calls it, of occultism, is that there is one omniscience which thrills throughout every finite point of the universe. Now, in this view, what it's suggesting that anything, any element, ultimately is an expression of the whole of existence. So this implies, and suppose you try to analyze a quanta or a particle, and the more you specify the position of that particle, then in a way what happens is that particle then blends back into the whole. So there's a point at which you come, the more closely you specify the position of the particle, it then blends into the infinity which underlies it, of which it is an expression. So the concept of zero points is like from a lower plane, as we trace something back to a zero point level, it passes beyond our perception into higher planes of existence. Because every atom or quanta is ultimately an expression of the whole. So this is why Blavatsky's teaching of zero points would have led you to predict the uncertainty principle, that you couldn't ultimately know the exact position of and momentum of a particle, because the more closely you analyze the particle, it blends back into the infinity of the whole. So zero points are like portals. As we trace something from a lower plane of perception, we trace it to a zero-point source, and then it passes beyond our perception into a higher dimensions, or it blends again with the infinity that underlies all things. Another quote from The Secret Doctrine by Blavatsky is, she says, deity is in every point of the universe. And if we take the traditional concept of God, God is described as omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient. So this implies, firstly, that God is everywhere. Blavatsky actually wouldn't use the word God so much, but leave that aside for the moment. That God is everywhere, and since God is omniscient, this means that the information about the whole of existence is somehow latent within every point. Because if God is everywhere, then any point somehow is an expression of that omniscience. And similarly, God is omnipotent. So God permeates everything, and God is omnipotent. So it suggests that if we could understand the true nature of space, we would realize there is an infinity of energy and potency throughout all of space. This is some of the concepts which are emerging in the new zero-point physics, that when physicists try to understand the nature of the quantum vacuum down a Planckian length, they find that all the energy, the zero-point energy and zero-point fields down at Planckian lengths, if you add up all the energy, the amount of energy latent throughout all of space is a huge, huge quantity. One author said the amount of energy at Planckian levels is equivalent to 10 to the order of 140 times the amount of matter and energy within the observable universe. So it's as if as you go down to zero-point levels, there's an infinity of energy that permeates all of space. So all this leads us to understand that the world as we ordinarily perceive it is really an illusion. It's really nothing like what it appears to our senses, which is exactly what Blavatsky said. She said, space and location, as we ordinarily understand these, have really no meaning. Instead, it's like a holographic projection. We can imagine sitting in the movie theater and watching a movie on a screen, and it's as though people in life, we watch the screen and see the movie playing out, And it's as if we take what's on the screen to be the true reality. And what we don't realize is that what's on the screen is really being projected from behind us from a film running and a light that projects that image on the screen. Well, in the same way, our common reality has the same illusory nature. Another analogy to this is Plato's description of, he says, let me show you how enlightened man is. And then he portrays man as living in an underground den, and there's a light behind them which projects their shadows onto the back wall of the cave. And the people in the cave take the shadows to be true existence. They don't realize that it's all a projection out of the light which exists behind them. And Plato says, imagine then we try to disillusion someone who lives in this shadow realm, and how hard it would be for them to turn around and to look into the light and to know true existence. And she explains it would take time for them to learn to look into the light and become accommodated to it. And gradually, though, a person might turn around and realize the true causes of existence which are projected out of this higher dimensional realm. And in Plato's analogy, the final part, he says, and finally would they see the sun in its own proper place and not in another. Similarly, in Blavatsky's teaching, the sun, in a way, is seen as our local deity or God's representative within our solar system. So the sun is not the deity, but the sun is an expression of the deity and the creative forces, which are an expression of the deity, which create life within our solar system. So Blavatsky sees there as being seven logi, or seven rays, or seven luminous suns, which are the spiritual intelligences within the sun which fashion life on Earth. Now, in modern materialist science, scientists think everything in nature is dead, in a sense. They don't consider that the sun is a living being, or the Earth is a living being, or the moon, or other planets. Whereas in an occult view of nature, all of these planetary and suns and galaxies and so on, they're living beings, and they all have zero-point centers. So Blavatsky actually discusses the nature of what she calls the invisible sun. And she depicts the invisible sun as being a zero point within the sun by which the sun itself is created, is rooted into higher dimensional space of what she calls the eternal parent space. So there is an invisible sun, this point source by which the divine intelligences from higher dimensions act through the mechanisms of the sun and then gives birth to life within the solar system. Now, these are very, very complex ideas, and as you may get some grasp a little bit, but the idea, most importantly, is that all living beings have zero-point energies. And although the concepts of zero-point fields are emerging in modern physics, it is only in the work of Helena Blavatsky where we actually come across the idea that we as human beings have such zero-point centers or origins. Now, in the beginning of The Secret Doctrine, Blavatsky is sitting before a book. There's a book before her, and on the first page she says there is a circle with a dull black background. And on the second page there is a circle with a point in its center. And she says that this represents the dawn of differentiation of a cosmos. So she predicted in 1888 that our universe emerged from a point source out of what she calls the eternal parent space. Now, what is really quite astonishing is that a century after Blavatsky, modern physicists now believe that our universe emerged from a singularity condition, a singularity is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in diameter. So scientists now believe our huge universe emerged from a point a billionth the diameter of a proton. Well, Blavatsky predicted this over a century ago. Modern physicists also believe in what they call vacuum genesis, the emergence out of the universe, out of nothing. Well, the stanzas of Zen, which form the basis of the secret doctrine, the first stanzas deal with the concept of there being seven nights of Brahma, where all of creation is absorbed in non-being. And Blavatsky says the seven luminous suns were not, time was not, the causes of misery were not. Mainly she's explaining how nothing was, not was, she says at one point. So Blavatsky, over a century ago, was explaining that at one point everything was absorbed in non-being, and then the universe emerged from a point source. And these basic concepts of Blavatsky have now been confirmed in modern science. They believe in vacuum genesis, that the quantum vacuum or space, which we thought was empty, is not really empty. Instead, it is a plenum or pleroma, and there's an infinity of energies and potencies and information latent within space itself. Anyway, these are just some of the beginnings of the profound ideas of Blavatsky, which now make considerably more sense in terms of the newest ideas in physics. My newest writing on this subject is a book called God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine. A second aspect of Blavatsky's work I'd like briefly to discuss, which I think in a way I've given a modern interpretation to, it concerns the issue of the nature of human consciousness. In modern times, the predominant scientific, or I would call it pseudoscientific theory, is that human consciousness is produced by material processes by the brain and that it's centered in the head. That's where the mind is, in the head, and somehow consciousness is produced by that brain. I call this the head dogma. I call it a dogma because no one actually understands what consciousness is, and no one's been able to explain how the brain produces it. In fact, the enigmas of consciousness are the most profound enigmas of modern science and psychology. In my book called The Heart Doctrine, again dedicated to H.P. Blavatsky, I explain that in all of the esoteric religious teachings of humankind, including Judaism and Kabbalah, mystical Christianity, Sufism and Islam, the Tibetan Buddhism of the Dalai Lama, yogic and Vedic teachings, and the secret doctrine, in all of these sources, the essential nature of human consciousness is regarded as having to do with the heart, rather than the brain in the mind. So, the origins of consciousness are connected to the heart, where you have, in Blavatsky's language, a monad, or like a spark of divine fire, a spiritual principle established in the higher dimensional physics of the heart. In yogic Vedic teachings, it's called the Jiva Atma. In Sufism, it's called the divine spark. Shirley MacLaine says the basic idea of the New Age is that everybody has a God spark within them. Well, 25 years ago, when I read Going Within by Shirley MacLaine, I became interested. Wow, what would be the physics and metaphysics of having God sparks? Does that make any sense from a scientific viewpoint? And indeed, the more and more I've studied that, I can now understand how this actually is not just a fable or a metaphor, but indeed there is actually a science, a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. The human heart is not simply soft muscle tissue. In fact, the heart exists on different planes or dimensions of existence. There's a physical heart, a psychical heart, a spiritual heart, and ultimately a divine source emanation. and there's a higher dimensional physics to the human heart. And the mysteries of the heart are elaborated throughout the esoteric spiritual teachings of humanity. So I elaborate this in great detail in my book, The Heart Doctrine. So these are two aspects of Blavatsky's work discussing the heart doctrine and the zero point concepts, which I have extracted from Madame's work and try to rejuvenate or to bring them out in light of modern science in order that we can reevaluate Blavatsky's work a century after she wrote The Secret Doctrine. In her time, Blavatsky explained, no one in this century will consider The Secret Doctrine seriously, but in the century to come, they will realize it has neither been invented nor exaggerated. And I think my work is dedicated to H.P. Blavatsky and is trying to bring these truths out, extracting them from The Secret Doctrine and relating them to issues in modern psychology and science. Okay, so that's a little background of my work and teaching. And today I'm going to introduce my co-host in a minute, and then on the half hour I was in to introduce our guest, but we may delay him for a moment more while I introduce my co-host, who's James Moffat. And Jim and I have been friends since high school, and there's really no one in the world who understands my work and has seen my development as fully as Jim has, and seen all the phases I've gone through in a lifetime of explorations of mystical and spiritual teachings. So Jim and I have shared through our life in our studies, and Jim's actually at the moment writing a book calling about on the problem of God's contracting universe, which is looking at my life and times and explaining how he's seen my work develop through the years and how it compares to modern science and psychology. So, Jim, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you well.
Okay, good.
Welcome, Jim.
Hi. Perhaps just explain that the problem of God's contracting universe refers to a statement that Carl Sagan made in his presentation he gave in the 70s called A Sunday Sermon, which is in his book Broke His Brain, where he says that as science advances, it seems that there is less and less for God to do, because now we have natural scientific explanations of phenomena which used to be attributed to divine micro-intervention. And he says that the quote is that it seems that as science advances, there is less and less for God to do. And you labeled this question or this statement, you said, well, is this true? And labeled this as the problem of God's contracting universe. Is it true that the advances of science diminishes God's domain? And even though at one point, I guess in the late 70s, early 80s, you began to write a book entitled that, and even though you abandoned that title, I think that title really is a good label for the entire corpus of your writings. I would say that the problem, that really everything that you've done for the last 30 years addresses the problem of God's contracting universe.
Yes, and trying to explore these ultimate questions of human consciousness and cosmic creation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think...
Yeah, I love that phrase, the problem of God's contracting universe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm honored that you're using that for the title of your book.
Well, I always... I really like the title a lot. I think it's a great title. And in science writing, people refer to the God of the Gaps, which is basically the same idea, is that the more knowledge we have, which is based on science, the less, the greater the shrinkage and the gaps in our knowledge, and therefore there seems to be less room for God. But what I think is really, I was reflecting on this the other day, and I sent you that email. I was rereading what I'd already written, and what I really see is that there are so many books out now and so many people discussing the idea of the science versus religion debate, but what's completely missing in this is that there's very few people who want to address these questions in terms of mystical and esoteric doctrines and the ideas of regarding the nature of consciousness and the self, which completely, I think, reconstrued the debate between science and religion. I think most of the debate between science and religion is based on false premises and doesn't really get at the heart of the matter. But you have to address consciousness to understand how we can reconcile both spirituality and science, and I think strengthen each of them and really challenge each of them to move forward in a much more progressive fashion and to be much more open-minded about what we know and what we don't know. I think both religion and science as institutions are really restrictive in the sense that people are taught things and accept as dogma things that they haven't really investigated for themselves and haven't really established within their own experience. And I think that's really one of the strengths of the esoteric and mystical tradition, is that you can understand these things in yourself and in the world if you study them systematically.
Yeah, and that religious tenets are not simply dogma and pseudoscientific. They, at the minimum, provide serious scientific hypotheses, like this concept that the origins of consciousness connect to the heart in mystical teachings, whereas modern science believes that the brain produces consciousness. You have to at least admit that the mystical views provide an intelligent framework of ideas worthy of being considered from a scientific perspective, not just as religious dogma, but as actually worthy of being investigated scientifically because of the uncertainties about consciousness. No one has any idea really what it is or how it's produced. So
yeah,
at the very minimum, it's a way of trying to evaluate religious teachings, at least esoteric religious teachings, from a scientific viewpoint.
Yeah,
which is, I guess, kind of really the theme of my life and your book, really, is how I've tried to bridge this gap between science and religion, not simply kind of based on belief, but rather tried to bring the esoteric doctrines into the scientific discourse and forum.
Yeah, exactly. And you're essentially, as am I, because of our scientific training, we're both empiricists, but we have a broader definition of that in the sense that we don't just think that that which is externally observable is worthy of the label of empiricism, but you can study your inner world. And the amazing thing that mystical and esoteric teachings provide is a system for exploring and also organizing your observations of your inner world. And the more you study your inner world, the more you realize that there's an entire cosmos, inner cosmos, that really has escaped modern science and psychology and really limits their appreciation of consciousness and really leads to what some people call the flatland of consciousness. I think that your teaching basically provides the idea that we're multidimensional beings in a multidimensional universe, and I would say that modern science and psychology and understanding the nature of consciousness is really restricted to the flat land. It doesn't go beyond the most simplistic dualities and dichotomies and doesn't realize the higher dimensionality nature of the self, consciousness, being, and how that's related to the multidimensional nature of reality and the universe.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because I argue also that there's overwhelming evidence that for psychical phenomena of various kind, which actually provide empirical evidences that we're not simply material biological beings, that there's evidences for out-of-body experiences, EFP, reincarnation memories, ghosts, all these psychical phenomena, and in a way, the mainstream scientists have become pseudoscientists because they simply close their eyes to all these enigmas and try to deny these phenomena. And then they don't take the further step of trying to comprehend how these things might indeed be true. So in a way, the scientists have become pseudoscientists.
Yeah, and really when you begin, what's very useful, at the very least, what's very useful from the framework that you derive your work from the esoteric and mystical teachings and traditions and the experiences of these people who provide these teachings is that what it really reveals is that as precise and as brilliant as so many scientific ideas and theories are, they're limited. There are definite limits to their scope of application. And when you begin to look outside of the limits of science, you begin to realize that there are all these essential unanswered questions, like what is the nature of life and what is the nature of consciousness? As you say, if science sees the universe as filled with basically dead matter, insentient matter and energy, how do we get life and how do we get consciousness? These are the most profound and yet unanswered questions in modern science and thought, and yet scientists ridicule and demean people who say that there's a spiritual intelligence which informs all of this. But really, when you begin to look at it, at the very least, if you take that idea seriously and you begin to explore the very elegant and coherent and comprehensive explanations that exist in esoteric and mystical traditions as to how these spiritual intelligences inform and underlie creation, you can derive a model which really challenges the understanding of modern materialist science and which is really actually much more comprehensive in terms of explaining things.
Yeah. Yeah, it addresses all those gaps where modern scientists, they do come to a gap that they can't reach, like how life emerges or what is consciousness. Or, you know, another quote I remember you introduced me to, it must have been 25 years ago, was Eddington's quote about, like, science has to, I'm not sure the wording of it, but consider the data of experience. Could you remember the quote, Jim?
I've never been able to find it, but I think it's essentially, he says that science, more broadly defined, is the earnest attempt to set in order the facts of experience.
Yeah, the facts of experience. Yeah.
Yeah.
That I always thought that so profoundly important because that's what modern science and psychology can't do because you do have all these people's accounts of spiritual and psychical experiences, and psychologists, in a way, simply close their eyes to all of that, and in a way, they can't account for the facts of experience. And so we need a broader conception of psychology and science.
Yeah, and as I say again, I mean, you just can't, I think it's Stanislav Grof who says that really, if you look at this materialist position in science, he talks about the greatest epistemological assumption is the idea that somehow you can explain life from this so-called dead or insentient matter and energy. How does life get produced? How does consciousness get produced? And I mean, people say, well, it's an emergent property, but that's just a label which really explains nothing. I mean, it just means that somehow it appears. But in a sense, it's funny, eh? Like Sagan's point is, well, science is doing away with is narrowing these gaps. But as you just said, really, when you look at it, the gaps are huge because science reaches its limits in terms of material explanations, and there's still these fundamental unanswered questions. And then there's the whole nature of all the anomalous experiences and phenomena that lie outside the scope of scientific explanation and are really just sort of denied or treated as if they don't exist, and that's the gap in scientific knowledge, and it's huge. I mean, it's like that quote from Uspensky where he says that if you take all of the the system-defying facts?
System-destroying facts.
System-destroying, facts. It really overwhelms the materialist explanation, and I would say that he said that 75 years ago, and I would say that's actually more true today, is that I think we've really sort of come to the point in our scientific explanations where, well, in fact it is true, where we come to realize that you have to account for consciousness or intelligence or information, whatever label you want to put on it, there's some sort of fundamental...
Yeah, or life. Life force.
There's some sort of basic principle there that it really makes everything work in the sense which is not recognized and which is beyond scientific material explanation. And again,
yeah.
Eddington said in the 1930s that he was summarizing where science, physics was. And then, you know, this is probably after about the most amazing 30 or 40 years in the history of science, the developments in physics, the development of relativity theory and quantum theory. And Eddington said something to the effect that what science and the physics had established was that we see, the world we see is a shadow world of symbols. And he was making a deliberate allusion to Plato's cave, which you explained earlier. And he said,
oh, yeah.
That's the limit of science. We can describe the shadows, but there's something beyond that. Now, some people have said that, and he made reference to mysticism. Some people were saying that, have said that he was saying that, that science had proved mysticism. He said, no, or religion. He said, no, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is that science can only go so far, and that mysticism provides a method which goes beyond scientific explanation, which may actually lead to more fundamental appreciation and apprehension of these underlying principles, which are beyond the shadows.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like also Rene Weber, who had that wonderful book, Dialogues with Scientists and Sages, where she makes that same point. She says, the mystics, in a way, they include themselves in the equations, whereas scientists kind of exclude themselves and the nature of their own consciousness from the equation, whereas mystics include themselves within the equation in their attempts to understand the universe. And I guess it goes back to that quotation, know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. So that implies that somehow attaining higher consciousness or knowing ourselves in a different way is a prerequisite to attaining a deeper understanding of the structure of reality or the nature of existence. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, exactly.
We've run over a little bit here, and I think we have a guest on the line, so we'll have some time. We'll come back, Jim, at the end of the show to kind of do a wrap-up and such, but I'd like to maybe move on. I'll introduce our guest, who's Charles Sitwell, and Charles is a longtime theosophist, and he's also been involved in the social credit movement in New Zealand. And I've invited him on the show today both to discuss theosophy initially, but then for him to share with us some of his understanding of the banking system and the problems in terms of the world situation, in terms of banking and the structure of our societies and such. Okay, Charles, are you there?
Who?
Oh, welcome,
hello.
Charles.
Charles, Matt.
Oh, are you hearing us okay?
Yes, sorry, go on.
Okay, how long have you been a theosophist? Did you grow up in a theosophical family or household, Charles?
No, not really. Are you sure you have the right person?
How did you come to...
Wait, whose name are you after?
Say again?
Seriously, whose name are you after? My name is Matthew, or Matt.
I didn't... you're breaking up your voice a little bit for me. I'm not hearing too clearly. Could you say something of how you came to theosophy and what appealed to you in theosophy as a teaching? Charles. Hello?
Hello?
Okay, I'm not sure. Are you there, Jim?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you're there. Were you able to hear Charles? He was breaking up a little bit for me.
I was able to hear. Yeah, I don't think we're connecting somehow. He's trying to
hear you.
You can hear?
Is that Charles?
Yeah, I can hear you. But
okay.
this isn't Charles.
Okay.
This is Matt.
Oh.
This is Matt. He was on before.
Oh.
I think Matt had the numbers mixed up.
Is Charles there?
No, this is Matthew or Matt.
Okay, I'm afraid I'm not sure who Mark is. Are you a theosophist, Mark?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Welcome. I'm sorry we're having just a little bit of trouble getting our guest on here, but we hope to have this resolved in a moment. So Jim and I are still back online, and hopefully Charles will be joining us in a minute.
Well, that was interesting.
What's that, Jim?
I say that was interesting.
Yeah, I think we got some other fellow. He was Matthew, and I asked him, "Are you a theosophist?" And
yeah.
He said, "No."
Not really.
Could you tell us about God?
Yeah. Well, not really. I'm not really sure what all that was about, but oh well, that's interesting.
Hey, just to go back, there was one point earlier we were talking about the idea of God of the gaps.
Oh, yeah.
And what I found so funny in a way is, you know, some of the quotations I use in my writing from Stephen Hawking, because it's so peculiar in a way, because Stephen Hawking, you know how the universe, the scientists trace the origin of a universe back to a singularity. And Hawking didn't like this idea of there being a singularity condition, because at a singularity, all the known laws of physics break down and it becomes unpredictable. So Hawking was trying to develop his quantum gravity theory in order to smear out the Big Bang singularity. And then he has this kind of philosophy, well, if we can smear out the Big Bang singularity, then we don't need God anymore for this last gap in modern science, which is the Big Bang singularity. Huh. And really, it's such an ironic statement, because firstly, the mystics predict the origin of the universe from a point source. Like you find it not only in Blavatsky's secret doctrine, but you also find it in Kabbalah and Hinduism and other esoteric traditions. So the very fact of tracing the universe back to a point source is really confirmation of the ancient wisdom teachings. And then the fact that Hawking would want to smear the Big Bang singularity out, in a way, is also consistent with mystical teachings, because Blavatsky also, it's like coming to a zero point, and as you come to a point, then that blends again with the whole, which is exactly what Hawking was trying to do in smearing out his singularity into into a quantum system. So it's funny, like, Hawking kind of thinks, oh, we can do away with God, if we develop a theory of quantum gravity theory, but everything he says is perfectly consistent with what the mystics have predicted or would have led us to predict.
Yeah.
So I think part of the problem a little bit is that modern science philosophers don't seriously know what is articulated in the ancient wisdom teachings, and that's part of the problem.
There's certainly that, and in addition to that, there's just, you know, there was a review of The God Delusion in the New York Review of Books, and I believe it was written by a biologist, but I don't quote me on that, but I think it was written, I'm pretty sure it was written by a scientist, and he said that really the interesting thing about Richard Dawkins is that when it comes to theological discussions, he's not very good at them. You know, he doesn't really know that much. Most of the God delusion is an attack on fundamentalists. Most of Carl Sagan's arguments against religion, he quotes or represents like literalist and fundamentalist interpretations, especially of the Bible. Like, it's interesting. He doesn't really get into other sacred scriptures too much, even though he'll quote from them, but I mean, anybody with a quotation book can do that. But he doesn't really show any evidence of understanding what they say. And none of these guys has a first clue about esoteric or mystical doctrine. So it's kind of funny. One of the things that you kind of run up against a little bit in trying to argue against these people is that they're portrayed as being like these brilliant thinkers, but really, when it comes to spiritual matters, they're really quite incompetent. That's the way I've coined what I call the fall prey to the Saint Peter principle. They reach their level of spiritual incompetence,
Oh yeah, Saint Peter after the Peter principle.
The Peter principle.
That's very nice. I like that.
Yeah, I call it the Saint Peter principle because really it's like sort of shooting fish in a barrel when you're attacking fundamentalists. Like, it's clearly absurd that the universe is not 4,000 years old. I think we can all agree on that, the most informed people. And it's certainly something to be concerned about, that people take these religious doctrines and they take them literally and fundamentally. And the idea that, you know, that the Bible is the literal word of God. Well, the Bible isn't the literal word of God, but at the same time, the Bible has meanings beyond that which people who believe it's the literal word of God, suppose it means. I mean, you can interpret the Bible esoterically in a completely different level of scale, and that's what these people never address. So it's kind of silly to think that, I mean, as you say, the example Hawking is really quite peculiar, is that he thinks that somehow that's going to do away with God. But I'm thinking, well, I don't even understand how he can think that. It's just not a very sophisticated conceptualization of God. And of course, if you said to somebody, well, you know, I know something Stephen Hawking doesn't know, they'd probably look at you and say, well, you know, he's the smartest person in the world. Well, he's pretty smart about physics, but he doesn't know squat about God, as far as I can see, you know, so.
Yeah. And it's also, we see how these people, like Hawking, who writes about the God delusion, they argue against the straw man. Like, they have this caricature of what religious teachings teach. It's a caricature. It's superficial. It's like a kindergarten-level understanding that they then, in their wisdom, debunk. But the whole thing is completely superficial and addresses none of the significant issues. Just one other thing I think is interesting in this regard. It's some bishop who actually came up with this concept.
Hello?
Concept.
I
don't know if my guest is. I will try to switch over in a minute. I'll just finish with this thought. Bishop, through the study of the genealogy presented in the Bible, came up with the date that the kind of birth of Adam, he traced, I think, actually to the year 4004.
Yeah.
And what's most interesting about that is if you study the work of H.P. Blavatsky, Blavatsky actually states that we are on the fourth of seven rounds of creation. And I think she would relate the Adamic period to the fourth root race of the fourth round. So the meaning of this year, 4004, could actually be related to the emergence of the fourth root race in the fourth round, according to the secret doctrine.
Yeah,
and
that was
so, in a way, that date of 4004, that's an example of how you might give that an esoteric interpretation instead of a little literalist one, as the fundamentalists do.
I believe that was Bishop Usher.
Okay,
that,
so I don't know, maybe our guest is available here. Is Charles, are you on the line?
I am, yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, welcome, Charles. Sorry, we had some trouble getting you on, and I hope we're not going to have trouble hearing you.
I hope not, too.
A nice sunny day in Hamilton today?
Yeah, it's not too bad. It's supposed to be clearing. We've got a bit of cloud at the moment. It should clear, they say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Okay, Charles, I thought...
Hello?
Again?
I can hear you, but can you hear me?
I can hear you. You break up a little bit, but if I listen carefully, it should be okay.
Okay.
I wondered firstly if you would say something about your coming to theosophy as an area of study and as a spiritual teaching, and what attracted you about the teachings of theosophy.
Well, I think it was probably the teachings about reincarnation, partly. And that there are seven levels of consciousness, at least. The idea that we're actually multidimensional people, not just physical people. Those are the two key things that attracted me. I've been aware of reincarnation for some time, and I found that it fits in very well. Can you hear that all right?
Well,
Chris, you're going to have to wait because you're cross-talking over Charles. Wait a little bit after he's finished because you're sort of breaking into what he's saying.
Okay. We don't seem to have a very effective. Yes, I'm here. We don't seem to have a very effective landline.
I wonder if you might talk with Charles, Jim, and be maybe not interfere a bit with him as much.
I'm not sure if that's going to work either.
What was it in the idea of reincarnation? How did you become interested in that, through personal experiences or reading accounts of it, or?
Well, it was a mixture of reading a number of books by different authors, partly fictional books, of course, but also my grandmother had a strong belief in reincarnation. But the thing was, it seemed to make sense. And as I read later, there are so many accounts of people with memories of past lives that you can't dismiss them. If you read Dr. Ian Stevenson's books, you realize that in any other field than theosophy, or theology, it would be accepted as a normal fact by statistical analysis. Is that coming across?
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes, Stevenson's work is really remarkable, and he was like a very competent psychiatrist at the University of Virginia and had some amazing cases providing evidential data for reincarnation.
Yep. That's right. And then further,
you say the concept of us being multidimensional beings, I think, is so important.
That's right. We are not just physical beings. We have a spiritual dimension. Or, in fact, it's the other way around, as far as I can make out. We are actually spiritual beings with a physical dimension. And this is why the scientists have so much difficulty, because they rule out their own consciousness, which is actually the key to understanding all the other things. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we're really spiritual beings having a material existence instead of material beings who might attain a spiritual life.
Exactly.
Yes, we see it. Yeah.
That's the conclusion. That's the sort of the basic teaching or idea behind theosophy, is that we are H.P. Blavatsky called it the cycle of necessity. We are beings who are passing through huge periods of time and experiencing physical existence. To understand what physical existence can be or what it is. That's my understanding of it.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
You
I
know,
have a question.
Who could say? Yeah?
H.P. Blavatsky was such a remarkable woman and actually introduced largely the idea of reincarnation and karma to the Western world.
Yes.
And kind of so ahead of her time, really.
That's exactly right. The interesting thing, of course, is that these ideas actually in the Eastern teachings go back 5,000 years or more. If you go back to the Vedas, all these ideas that we're discovering now are talked about. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah.
At least to me it is.
The Vedas date back 5,000-6,000 years, I think, some of them, don't they?
So it said, yes. I mean, the huge range of dates of the historians assign, varying from about 1200 BC to 5000, and you can pick your choice according to which school of teaching you read. But effectively, they antedate us by a long way, we can say that. You know,
I was just going to say that reincarnation was part of Christianity, I think, until the Council of Nicaea in 324 or something like that. But it was certainly part of the original teachings of the Christian fathers, and it was only later that it was removed. But I wanted to ask Charles about his feeling about reincarnation, if he thinks that people or that beings actually physically reincarnate, or if there is in some way that in certain incarnations we can access memories of previous incarnations. I don't know if that distinction is coming through, but what's his understanding of it?
My personal belief, and there's lots of schools of thought on this, but my personal belief is that there is an ongoing entity which is our causal body, if you like, using a theosophical term. It's a reflection at the lower level of the monad. H.P. Blavatsky talks about the monad as the essential permanent atom, so to speak. And that reflects down, this is why I'm fascinated with the multi-layer or multi-dimensional nature, because we are actually a reflection of a reflection of a reflection when we're in our physical consciousness. I don't know if that's too complex for this sort of talk. Probably is. But anyway, there is something which people like to call a higher self, which is really our real self. Okay? We're a focus of consciousness in the physical body at the moment. And that focal point exists independent of the physical body. It uses a physical body when we incarnate. And our actual memory of it is a permanent ongoing record that we can access between lives, as I understand it. And we fit all the experiences that we're having into an ongoing record.
The monad is like the eternal principle within us then.
Yeah. Yes. That's right. And it
similarly to the jiva atma.
Yes, same idea.
Yeah.
And it's at a very high level of spirituality, but it steps down, you know, like a transformer process going on. We come down into the physical through a series of steps, and there's something we tend to refer to as a causal body, which is because it causes the physical body, which is where we sort of retreat to between lives. And the essence of that is the monad. Is that okay?
Yes.
We have the relationship of the higher self to our physical selves is a reflection or replication of the relationship between the higher self and the monad. They're essentially the same entity, but at different levels of manifestation. It's very abstract. But it's a process of descent into materialism. We get more involved at each descent into a denser or a more physical environment.
Yeah.
So we are physical. We think of ourselves as physical beings, but in fact we are spiritual beings using a physical vehicle. That's the basic idea. And HPD
yeah.
says there is no dead matter. Consciousness is everywhere. So it's in mineral, but latent in the mineral, and more active in the plant, and much more active in the animal, and then it sort of focuses in the human. Can we use, perhaps if we use an analogy, think of light. Light can be very diffuse, if you like. Starlight is throughout the universe, but it's not very bright. So when you focus it in the sun, it becomes very bright. And in the same way, ordinary light on Earth, if we have a laser, compare a laser beam with a searchlight, we find it's much more concentrated. So you could think of consciousness in the animal as a searchlight and consciousness in the human as a laser beam, just as an analogy. Does that help?
Yeah.
Or does it make it more complicated?
I think, yeah, so it's like reflections on different planes of density or different planes of reality. I like how you describe us as being a reflection of a reflection of a reflection as that consciousness comes down into the physical.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
So here's a quote from Blavatsky about the monad.
She says,
a monad, she says, it is not of this world or plane and may be compared only to an indestructible star of divine light and fire thrown down onto our earth as a plank of salvation for the personalities in which it indwells.
Okay.
That's a nice, beautiful quotation.
Yes. Another way of getting to the problem about consciousness in the brain, which worries the psychologist tremendously, as it should, is Rupert Sheldrake's rather nice analogy of the brain as a television set. And he points out you can vary the signal. If you poke a television set with a screwdriver, you may distort the picture or get a bit of the picture. But you won't find the story or the actors because they're not in the set.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. It's only an instrument or a receiver.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is the difference between the brain and the mind, you see. The brain is a physical tool which the mind uses to focus thoughts or to manipulate thoughts and to use thoughts. So we can actually control our thoughts. If you sit down and decide to think about a certain thing, you can do that. Because clearly we're operating from a higher level than the ordinary thought level. At least that's an analogy I like to use. In the same way that we can control our physical body. You can control your foot.
It's similar to this work of a famous Canadian neurosurgeon, Wilder Penfield, who was one of the original researchers of the brain, who stimulated the brain in awake subjects. And he could stimulate a part of the brain and produce different experiences. For example, a person would see a butterfly, or they would raise their arm. But he said, whenever people experienced these experiences, there was always the I observing the phenomena, which was always seen independent of the phenomena produced by the neurological stimulation. So it was like the eye was always separate from the functions of the brain, which is exactly as you're saying, Charles.
Yeah. The eye is a mechanism for transferring external stimuli to the brain, which then reports to the mind, if you like, or shows the mind what it is and says, what is it, what's that? The mind says, oh, it's a butterfly. Yeah?
Yeah.
Because that's how we conceive of a butterfly. But what the mind sees is a patterned insect or an object, a kind of object. And it's not until we analyze it in our minds and say, oh, well, that's what we call a butterfly. So there's the thought, which is separate from the physical reaction to an external object. And we have to decide whether it's a butterfly in a picture or a real butterfly by the way it operates and so on.
Theosophy provides such a complex teaching about these multidimensional processes, and I don't think there's any other teaching that addresses these issues as thoroughly and comprehensively as Blavatsky does. Do you know anything comparable, Charles, to the teachings of Theosophy?
Only some of the more advanced levels of the schools of yoga in India, going back. I mean,
yeah.
But they're more interested in the more abstract aspects of consciousness, and merging the physical, the human consciousness with the divine consciousness or the universal consciousness. But a lot of the Theosophy comes from that teaching. Blavatsky didn't invent it. She was a compiler or a transmitter of the wisdom. She was trying to bring the ancient wisdom back into our awareness, because it existed. A lot of it's been there for thousands of years. It's simply making sense of it in terms of our scientific perceptions of the cosmos, and combining that with the mystical teachings of the centuries, basically.
Yeah.
There have been a few tears over the centuries who have seen truly by getting into a mystical state. But we're trying to bring it down now so that we can do it at a scientific state. That's the difference, I think. But we do need our scientists to acknowledge that there is such a thing as consciousness. And then they'll be able to really take off. And most scientists,
yeah,
if you ask them, they'll tell you that they're conscious. Have you ever met a scientist who claimed that he wasn't conscious?
Yes, actually, some of them did.
Okay. Yes.
John Watkins, the early behaviorist.
Right. Yeah.
It's funny because it really
truth funny.
Yeah, consciousness is the most primary given in our experience, and to deny it is absurd. And yet scientists have attempted to do that, to exclude it. But yeah.
Well, they exclude it because they have no explanation for it, I think.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I know that's here, Charles. You and I think, are having a little bit of trouble. I'm having trouble hearing you at times, and I think there's a delay in here. I guess your message is going to California and coming back from California to New Zealand to me, and then I answer from New Zealand, it goes to California, and then it goes back to you in New Zealand. So there's a little delay in here. But at times it's hard a little bit working together here, but let's move along a little bit, and maybe you would share something about your involvement with the social credit movement, and what are some of the basic platform issues, what have those been in terms of the social credit movement and your perspective on the banking and finance within our society? Perhaps you might share along that line.
I think the basic idea is that industry and commerce and all of these activities should be for the benefit of humanity as a whole, rather than for a small section of it. There's nothing wrong with a small section having a benefit, but it should be more equitably distributed. And there are certain systemic reasons why that doesn't happen. It's not the evil intent necessarily of individuals. They're simply doing what is part of the system as it's been set up. But the question is, what is it that's wrong with the system? And C.H. Douglas, who was a engineer and had an interest in economy in the 1930s, examined part of his work. He was working for an aircraft factory. He realized, after looking at a number of documents on the way money is distributed, that the wages and the salaries and the dividends that are distributed are never as great as the price of the goods that they make. Okay? And he called that a gap. And the gap is filled at the moment by the monetary system lending money into existence with an interest charge. So money should, the basic concept is that money should equal the value of the goods being produced, and it should be related to that. When you get a loan from a bank, it creates money not against production that's going to be produced, but against your assumed ability to repay it, right? So it's a totally different, it's based on the wrong criteria. That's the fundamental problem. There's a whole lot of stuff that goes with it. But in the time we've got, that's the basic fault. That money is not directly related to goods and services, but it's produced out of nothing by the banking system. That's a statement that's probably upset a lot of people. But many of the directors of the banking industry over the years, when they've been testifying to commissions of inquiry about how the money system works, have said quite categorically, yes, of course, the banks create credit. And they create it out of nothing. They write it in their books. And they stated this quite clearly. Lord Montague the Bank of England said it about 30 years ago. The chairman of the Federal Bank in New Zealand said it in 1956 when there was a commission of inquiry. The same statement's been made by bankers to the United States Senate when they had an inquiry into the money system, and so on. And indeed, the Canadian government had an inquiry some years back, and the same statement was made. So it's not an outrageous statement, it's a fact. But it produces all sorts of distortions in the way the money system works. But that's the sort of basic point. Does it make any sense?
Yes, it does. So what would be an alternative would be for if governments actually had their own bank and produced their own money and invested it in infrastructure within their countries? Would that be a way
that's
of...
That's right. That indeed would be a way of doing it. And in fact, Abraham Lincoln did do that to some extent during the American Civil War. He went to the bankers in America and said he needed some money to run the war. And they said, of course, Mr. President, we'll have this high risk, so it's wartime, so we'll have to charge you a high interest rate. And he said, virtually said, blow that, and issued greenbacks. So he got around it that way. Of course, he got assassinated. Whether that was related or not, it's another story. But basically, if the government has the power to issue currency, and it delegates it at the moment to the commercial banks, who then issue it at interest rate. There is no earthly reason why they cannot. And in fact, in New Zealand, it was done in the late 1930s to issue money, and subsequent to that, into the 40s and 50s, issue money directly from 5% the government, or it can be from the Reserve Bank. And the point is, it's no more inflationary. They will say it would be inflationary, but it can't be any more inflationary than the banks doing it at the same thing, with an interest rate piled on it. So if government issues its money directly for infrastructure, or not for just day-to-day groceries, that wouldn't be sensible at all. But if it's put into the circulation for building bridges or building railways or building infrastructure that is needed. Voter approved. There was a bill that was being introduced in America a couple of years ago by a chap by the name of Ken Bondack. Have you heard of him? Know of him?
No, I hadn't.
Christopher? Okay.
No, I hadn't heard
of
him.
I can't remember. There was a bill. I don't know how far it got, but he got support from a number of senators and a lot of municipal bodies throughout the state for it. But it kept getting delayed because the Senate changed and they had to reintroduce it. I don't know the mechanisms of the American system. I don't want to get into that. I don't know enough about it. But anyway, he was having a lot of success with the local bodies, and they could see the sense of it. Because if you borrow money from a bank, you pay in over 25 years, you pay three times the amount back. Whereas if you get it from at cost of issue and pay back just the capital, you only pay for things once. So that's clearly less inflationary. It seems to make a lot of sense.
Yes, it certainly keeps people impoverished through their life. When you buy a house for $150,000, and by the time you paid it off, you paid $500,000, and the banks made $300,050 off your life. I mean, it keeps, as you say, it keeps people impoverished, and all the time it is feeding these vast sums of money to the banks, which has then seemingly impoverished different nations. Like, it seems most nations of the world have massive debts owed, I guess, to the banking community.
Yep. This is the problem. It's not the problem. It's a large part of the problem, though. I think we can sometimes get a bit carried away and say that's the whole story. But if we change a few things, not that extensive, it would make things so much better. Economically for a lot of countries, including our own, of course.
Yeah.
And
Jim, did you want to ask a question?
No, I just, I mean,
okay.
If Charles could just amplify a little bit more, it's interesting. Hearing what he has to say, it's a very different perspective on things.
Well, it is. That's why we're so keen on it. It would lead to a much more equitable society if we implemented some of these ideas. The basic thing that people have got to get hold of, though, is that our current money system, about 97% of it is represented by digits in computers in the banking systems around the world. Most people think of money as notes and coins, but that actually is about 3% of the total money supply. And the rest of it is actually fictitious in a sense. It doesn't exist anywhere except in the computers of the banking system. And for that, they charge us 3, 4, or 5% or interest rate for doing something which actually costs them nothing. And it sounds totally unbelievable, but they talk about the banks lending their deposits, but they're not allowed to. If they actually lent their customers' deposits, they'd be head up for misappropriation of money and all sorts. Nobody's ever gone into a bank and been told they can't have their money because they've lent it to somebody else. And that's a big difference between the way the commercial banks operate and an individual loaning money. If you loan money to somebody, you actually forego the use of the money until it's repaid. But the banks don't have that problem because it gets paid straight back into a bank, and that increases their reserves. Now they can lend some more against that. it's a very strange system we've got into over the years. It's been going for about 300 years now in its present form. Well, the Romans had a go at it, incidentally, and probably contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire. I'm not saying it caused it, but it suspected contributed. They had the same sort of racket going on. It's a system that makes one wonder why people fall for it so easily, but it's put across so determinedly. Many of the textbooks in schools tell, say, well, now children, what happens with money is that people earn some money, they take it along to the bank, and they invest it, and they deposit it, and then the banks invest it in other activities to help other people. That isn't how it works at all. Money is recorded as being their money, and it stays there, so recorded. And the banks lend against it, so they claim. But what they do is create new money, which doesn't cost them anything to do, and they charge the interest. Does that sort of clarify the system at all? Or are you left totally disbelieving?
It's very hard to really grasp the complexity of the system. And I've been struggling with it since I watched that video with you, I think entitled Money as Debt. And it explains how essentially the banks create money by creating debt, and it's really all on paper. And really, in a way, there's no reason for that system to have evolved in that form. And really, if the governments issued their own monies, well, then you wouldn't have this cumulative interest, which is sapping the wealth of nations so that they all end up owing the banks vast amounts of money. In a way, there was no reason for that if nations had their own banks and had an alternate system, as you've explained.
Yeah.
It's interesting how people get no education in this and really have no understanding of this. I think we need a whole educational push for people to grasp this systemic problem. As you say, it's a systemic problem that goes back hundreds of years. It's not just a few, and even people in the banking system even acknowledge it themselves, as you've stated.
That's right. Most of the ordinary employees in the banks are ignorant of the rest of the public on this. But when you get near the top of the system, where they really have had to dig into what they're doing, they do know. You know, Abraham Lincoln said that the creation of money is a government's greatest responsibility and also its greatest creative opportunity. He wasn't a fool.
Wow.
Yeah. It's interesting.
When did Abe Lincoln live in relation to the institution of the Federal Reserve in the United States? Was the Federal Reserve created as a separate private body? Was it in 1917 or some time in there?
I think, you may be right. I thought it was 1913, but somewhere about there. But the federal bank in America is a collection of the private banking system. It's run by the commercial banks. It's not a national bank at all. It behaves like it, or it purports to be, but it actually isn't. I don't know how many people realize that. I was quite shocked when I found that out. But it isn't. It's not.
I don't think people realize that and what it means.
Very interesting. Yeah.
So in Canada, it is said that of our tax dollar, 80 cents on every tax dollar goes towards paying the interest to the banks. 80 cents on every dollar. And it's so peculiar because if you had an alternate system and the government created the monies through their own bank well, then that 80 cents on the tax dollar wouldn't be required as interest. So the government would have like four times as much tax revenue as they have. Like they would have a huge amount of money for reinvestment in the country itself, instead of all the time paying 80% of our tax money to the banks. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's right in theory. I don't know about the figures, but that's the theory, yes.
No.
How it goes. We have the same problem in New Zealand, and all the other Western countries that operate the same banking system have the same problem. They go to the banks to borrow money. Which is crazy, in my opinion.
It's interesting.
As you say, the structure of the banking system then has naturally led to the emergence of an extremely wealthy elite and the impoverishment of the peoples of the countries of the world, all with huge, massive national debts.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And it's inevitable the way it's set up, because the banks, ultimately, if they lend all that money to people against securities, if they can't repay it, and after all, they're repaying not just the interest, the basic capital, but they've got to find the interest from somewhere, which raises the question, where does the interest get created? And the answer is by another bank loan somewhere, which they have to access somehow. So there's always more money to be paid back to the bank than actually exists. You see the problem. So the result is that's why we get these. I mean, look at the foreclosures that are going on in the American housing scene at the moment. I've been hearing about that, and presumably the when they foreclose, the properties go to the bank, who then presumably sell it. So they get real money for in return for something they created out of the stroke of the computer key. There's something a bit peculiar there, isn't there? Yes, far
it's
I can make out that
situation
exactly what happened. It's
a terrible situation in the States where 2.5 million people may be losing their homes because of this.
Yes. Okay. It doesn't seem quite fair somehow, does it? Put it mildly.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Are you
familiar with the quotation? We have a problem here sometimes because of the delay. I start speaking and you start before I come across, and we're overlapping a little bit. So, anyway, Charles, are you familiar with the quotation from the Rothschilds one of the Rothschilds said, "I don't care who the government is. All I care about is who issues the money." Is that a famous quotation?
Yes, it is. Yeah. I can't decide. Did that work?
Yes.
Sorry?
Oh.
When was that quotation from? I've heard that.
Christopher, I've just been handed a note by my son, who was listening to the radio show on his machine, and he said it was pulled off the air when you said that the dollar of Canada, with 80 cents of the dollar went to paying taxes. They say your show has been pulled off. He says the show has been pulled off the air.
Wow. Okay. So we're not on the air now?
Well,
we're playing music.
Oh.
I can't hear.
Thank you.
I can't hear anything now. We're being scrambled. Okay. Yes?
Okay. This is Don Newsom. I'm the producer in the back room here. For all you folks who wanted to know, he is on Station 1 still. Station 2, it was cut off because we're doing more programming and running some music right now while we're doing some pre-records. This program is normally on Station 1, will always be on Station 1. If somebody clicks on Station 2 and hears the programming, that's only because we bonused the host and we're running it out on both stations, but that is not the norm. Thank you,
okay.
And I apologize for the interruption. I just wanted to correct you and your guest and let the audience know.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Don. Yeah. Okay, Charles, let's come back then. It's interesting how people have no education on these issues. Like, people really don't understand these issues of how money is created in our society and how the systemic problems here have generated these huge national debts and so impoverished the people of all the countries of the world have such huge debts.
That's absolutely right. And it's not just that they're ignorant, it's that they're misinformed, which makes it worse. They actually teach in the schools that banks lend their deposits. The people take money, earn money, take them into the bank and deposit it there, and that the banks then lend that to other people to use while it's not being used by the owner. And it's just not true. But that's what's taught in schools. So it's a misinformation system as well as ignorance.
So there's really been this essentially massive deception of the public, so that they haven't comprehended this aspect of the financing in our nation and how the banking system works. And do you think the people in political parties understand this, or is it just that the parties themselves are simply being supported by the banks and so maintain the deception?
I think the latter is probably true. At least that's the generous interpretation. our finance minister, Michael Cullen in New Zealand, was asked by one of our members, wrote to him and asked him if it was true that the banks lend their deposits. And he wrote back and said, yes, that's perfectly true. And of course we know it isn't. I would hesitate to suggest that he was trying to deceive people, so I assume he must actually believe it. And a tremendous number of people do. I mean, he wouldn't be on his own if he believed that, because that's what's taught. So I think most of the politicians firmly believe that that's how it is. And it ain't, in short.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
That's why we've got a problem.
It's interesting that... Just say something here. It's interesting that in Canada, for as long as I can remember, it's always been sort of a standard article of faith, something that is repeated. It's just an assumption about the entire financial system, is that in Canada we have a limited number of chartered banks, and it's always been said that these banks have to be very strong, that the stability of the economy is entirely dependent upon the strength of these banks. And it's kind of like, so they're accorded every opportunity to make money for basically doing nothing. And it's just part of a general feature of the system that nobody ever seems to question, which I think is kind of one of the things that Charles is getting at in his discussion of this issue. Like, it's just so ingrained in people's thinking that nobody really questions it.
Absolutely. That's the whole point. It's the official mythology that we live under.
That's a good term, the official mythology. Yes. And it's like people who aspire, like the social credit did in New Zealand. And in Canada, we now have what's called the Canadian Action Party, where this woman, Connie Fogel, that's the main platform of the Canadian Action Party, is they want to look at the restructuring of the financial aspect of the and banking system of Canada to address this problem. But it's so interesting in Canada that this party gets no coverage from the major media. So it makes it almost impossible for them to make progress. I wonder, did the social credit movement face that same issue in New Zealand?
Well, at the moment, that would certainly true, yes, but there's been a bit more problems here in a sense, which would take too long, I think, for this program. We got to up to 21% of the popular support before, in 1981 election. But our system then was the first past the post, and we only got two seats in Parliament. And so we diverted our energy into changing the political voting system, to which we've succeeded in doing. We now have what's called a mixed member proportional system, MMP, but that's a slightly different issue. But in that time, we sort of lost traction with our publicity for the cause itself. I think it's probably worth it, because now there is a much more theoretical opportunity, but we're sort of starting again politically. So that's probably why we're not getting much coverage at the moment. Incidentally, yeah. In Canada, of course, you've had two states which had social credit governments. One was Alberta, and the other was British Columbia. And Alberta, they will say, oh, well, they found oil, so that sort of any good they did was attributed to that. In British Columbia, they tried to bring in some reform bills, and the federal government blocked them. So they could only partially try and do what they believed in doing locally. But they were
blocked by the feds. Mm. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are issues that have to be addressed at the federal level then, really. Like
a
province in Canada couldn't affect such change. So, and they were actually blocked by the federal government.
That's right.
And the federal government is obviously blocking those not to serve the people of British Columbia, but to serve the interests of the banking community, who would obviously resist people learning about these things or resist the public wanting to take back the sovereignty of their nations.
That would seem to be the logical conclusion to draw, yes.
Yes.
Without accusing the federal government of any wrongdoing, but I think that does seem to be the answer. One would just have to assume that.
Probably
in all ignorance. You know, they probably believe that to do the social credit thing would be inflationary, because that's what they've been told by the gurus, who happen to be the bankers. Strange.
I guess. Wow, it's such a huge issue, actually. If this was actually changed in the world, I mean, it would lead to revolutionary changes throughout the world in terms of nations having the wealth of their own nations for their own peoples, instead of the wealth of the world being siphoned off to the elite banking community. It would be such a massive change throughout the world if people understood the systemic problems that we're addressing here.
That's right. You see, the problem is people will first ask, where is the money to come from, rather than looking at whether they've got the goods to do the job. Classic example of this was East Timor. Now, they announced after it achieved its freedom that they had roads to build and infrastructure to repair, and 75% of the population were unemployed. Now, does that not seem a bit absurd? They got machinery there to build roads. They've been building roads. You know, and basically what you need is to dig a road and put some stones down and then roll it. People have been building roads for centuries. It doesn't have to be too high-tech in the first instance. Another example was some years back, there was a program for taking water to a Mexican village, and their local government had borrowed some money from an American bank in order to pay for this to be done. So they bought the tools, they bought shovels, they dug a ditch, and they were a few hundred yards from completing it when for some reason they ran out of money, and they went back to the bank and wanted to borrow some more. And the bank said, oh, well, you haven't completed it on schedule, so it'll be much higher risk. Your interest rates will have to go up. And they said, well, they couldn't afford that, so they didn't borrow the money. And the workers were all sacked because there was no money to pay them. So they all went home, left their shovels and whatever in the ditch and sat on the dole. You know, I mean, if they just carried on and finished the digging, they'd have had their water. It's that sort of obsession with money. We actually are physical people who can do things. We've got resources. And the money should be just the standard phrase is a coordinator of resources, not a commodity. You see, this is the trouble. Money is regarded as a commodity that you can trade. And they've made it such. And it is at the moment. But in fact, its only real purpose is to make a barter system unnecessary. You know, if you've got a cow and you want butter, or you want, a basket or woven goods or clothing, it's very inconvenient to have to give the clothing person a whole cow. But if you've got money, then you can give him the appropriate amount. And that's where the thing started. But it's got so out of hand, where instead of just being enabling you to do trading, it's become a thing in itself, grown into a huge international industry without any relation to the physical world, which is, you know, the outcome of the system. And it's very profitable to those involved, of course. Hugely so.
Yeah.
One of the big international financiers some a year or two ago said, of course, the governments of the world should stop allowing the international capital to slosh around the way it does at the moment, because it's ruining the economy of all the countries. And then they said, but as long as they do allow it, I'm going to take advantage of it, because it's very profitable. So they actually came out and said that.
Yeah.
I'm not going to quote him now, because I might have got it a bit out of, you know, I might have misquoted him slightly, but that actually was said by an international financier. It was an interesting comment.
It's such a huge issue, and it's a very complex one to get one's mind about, and I know I'm still struggling myself to understand it, but I know that I need more education about it. And it's interesting, there have been two major new movies available on the internet addressing the larger world issues, which both have addressed these issues of the structure of the banking community. And one of these movies is produced by Alex Jones at PrisonPlanet.com and is called Endgame. And it's all about what the Bilderberg Group and the world banking system and so on. And the other movie that I would recommend to listeners is to watch the movie Zeitgeist. Zeitgeist is a German word meaning the spirit of the times. And this also is available on the internet if you go to video.google.com. And I would recommend to people that they watch these two movies, both Endgame and Zeitgeist. And I think those movies put into perspective what these issues about the banking system, how that then ties into the problems of humanity upon this planet. So I would recommend those to listeners as movies that address the kinds of issues we've been attempting to come to terms with here today. Charles, I don't know if we're running down. We have about 10 minutes left. Thank you for coming today. I don't know if you had any last thoughts that you would like to end on. I can give you a minute or two more.
Well, I think basically I'd like to hope that people get hold of the idea that money should be a means of enabling them to exchange their work for goods, and that it should relate to physical conditions, not the thousands of millions of dollars which don't relate to trade at all. They're just exchanged on the stock exchange or in the financial trading areas. There's lots of capital around the world. They actually don't relate to anything physical. So that is part of the problem. That's one thing to get hold of. Aristotle said that to treat money as a commodity was one of the worst forms of abuse, to treat it as though it was like cattle that can reproduce itself. So that's 2,000 years ago. This isn't a new problem. and the other thing, of course, is going back to theosophy, that we are spiritual beings who have a physical body, not the other way around. But if people can get those two fundamental ideas, life would be a lot better for everybody, for many people. But they wouldn't be so afraid of dying, for instance, if you believe in reincarnation. And it does seem to be the most rational answer. And Ian Stevenson has proved it to the satisfaction of most people, I would have thought, statistically. So those two thoughts I'd like to leave people with. Money is a means of exchange, not a commodity, if it's used rightly. And we are part of a recurring life cycle. Death is just an instant in it. Makes life much happier if you believe those two things. Okay?
I would like to quote some from the Bible, I think something that ties those two issues together a little bit, which is the idea, what benefits it to a man to gain the world but to lose his soul? And it's like this banking scheme has kind of allowed the wealth of the world to be accumulated by such a small elite, but what good does it do them when they also face this issue of death? So what benefits it to you to be part of such a scheme to impoverish the human race and to lose through that process, to lose your soul? I think in a way the human race needs to grasp these issues. In a way, I would rather live in poverty and have a soul than to be an elite and to lose my heart and soul. I don't think in the long run that would be to my advantage.
Thank you
very much, Charles, for being a guest today.
Sorry.
I'm sorry we had some difficulty.
Yes. Okay.
I'm sorry we had some difficulty. Oh, I'm not sure I get feedback or we're overlapping in speaking. I'm sorry we've had some difficulty in the communication exchange, but I think some of the basic points of what you've raised have been very valuable, and I thank you very much for honoring us and being our guest today. That's Charles Tittman from Hamilton, New Zealand. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Bye.
Thanks, Charles.
Goodbye. Jim.
Yeah.
Hi, Jim.
Yep. I'm here.
Yeah. I guess that's what happens. Like, having Charles on, I think he and I, were you getting a delay in he and I? Or were you hearing us normally?
You guys were cross-talking all the time because I think you identified it properly. I think, somehow that problem doesn't exist between us, but it does, even though you guys are in the same country, which is kind of peculiar, but I think maybe you were describing properly what was happening. But anyway, it got better after a while because you were both waiting and it wasn't so much after a while, but well, it was just one of those things.
Yeah, well, because there was that delay, that when he would stop talking and then I would start, but then he hadn't heard me, so he started. And it was a shame a little bit, but I hopefully it didn't come across to the audience in that way.
I think it did.
He certainly raised profoundly important issues, and I hope people need to be trying to understand more of this, of the kind of economics of our society. And, you know, I'm still myself trying to grasp the complexity of this. And, it's just an immensely important issue if we want to try to address the problems on this planet at this point in human history. We certainly see how the peoples of the world, in a way, have really become impoverished. And the wealth of the nations has been, it reminds me of Uncle Scrooge. He has this kind of, you know, I understand the Rothschild estate is estimated at $100 trillion. And one must wonder, like, wow, if you had $100 trillion, would you let 25,000 people starve a day? Like, it's a shocking situation, and it's not just individual so much, it's a systemic problem. And I think
absolutely.
We really need people in the banking community and the political community to have some change of heart and to look at this. And, you know, the banks need to serve the peoples as well, just as the people, you know, we need good and strong banking community. I think there's truth to that. But we don't need a banking community that impoverishes the human race.
Yeah, but Chris, you know, these people have all this money and this power, and they've just concentrated it more and more over the last 40 years. There's a smaller and smaller elite that controls things. The likelihood of them changing is zero. You know, they're not going to give this up. I mean, it's just so ingrained in the system, and these people would sell their mothers for a nickel. I mean, it's just that simple. I mean, it's such an incredible thing. But the problem is that people don't even kind of challenge it. I mean, you can't even get people to talk about with the current system. I got to tell you about this quickly, this thing that there's a book by this guy, quite a scholar. His name is Chalmers Johnson, and he's written a book called The Sorrows of Empire, and the subtitle is Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, about the United States. And he quotes a report from Insight magazine in May of 2001. It says the Deputy Inspector General at the Pentagon, quote, admitted that $4.4 trillion in adjustments, $4.4 trillion to the Pentagon books had to be cooked to compile required financial statements, and that $1.1 trillion was simply gone. No one could be sure of when, where, or to whom the money went. And he goes on, he says, this amount is larger than the $855 billion in income taxes paid by Americans in the fiscal year 1999. The fact that no one seems to care is also evidence of militarism. And that's, you know, I mean, in the States, that's the point, is that there's this very small elite of people who benefit from this extraordinary, stupid, and wasteful policy, which basically makes the United States this militaristic country, even though they pretend that they're, you know, promoting peace and democracy. And these people are getting fabulously wealthy on taxpayers' money, you know? It's not making people pay all these taxes. It doesn't make them safer. It makes these people more rich and more powerful and more manipulative. And, you know, people quibble over stupid little political ideas that come nowhere near addressing the central problem, which is that these goofballs are bleeding everybody dry. You know, it's just, and they're not going to give it up. I guarantee you that they're not going to have a change of heart, you know. It's just so ingrained in the system. It's really quite disgusting. I mean, that's even if you kept the existing system with the banks. I mean, that whole thing with the banks is pretty amazing. And as you say, it's enormously complex. But as Charles pointed out, money only exists because, you know, we don't want to have the barter system. And most of the money is created and destroyed, you know, in cyberspace. It doesn't even exist. It doesn't really exist.
It's figures on the computer page.
Yeah.
And then
it's just calculations. You know, it has no reality really. So It's pretty bizarre, but I liked what he said, though, that we're spiritual beings that have, you know, a physical presence, a physical body. It's like if you turn everything over, it's like if everything goes base over apex, then the question isn't should we be debating whether or not we're actually really spiritual beings, but we should be sort of saying what's really real about the physical state, physical presence. You know, this is the temporary thing. The spiritual is the eternal and ongoing principle and is the source of information and intelligence.
Yeah, it shows the short-sightedness of the elites in a way. They think they're kind of beyond death and they see nothing
yeah.
in this whole thing as that bears upon the life of the soul and what will become their own fate. You know,
yeah.
as Gurdjieff says about Hastnamath individuals, that they're going to face severe kind of retributive kind of states and experiences and sufferings for the things
yeah.
that have happened on this planet. I mean, it's terrible to see the people of the United States and the nation of the United States, the once great United States, being impoverished in this way, and the 2.5 million people losing their homes. And then the government won't even cover the benefits for veterans who have been made sick by depleted uranium and all the destructive things that have been done to their own soldiers who they tout that they're looking after and they serve so much. The whole situation, there's such problems in America as elsewhere in the world. It's really disheartening and I think the info war is just so important that people become educated and learn more about what's happening in their world and in their communities. Okay, so we're down to the wire here, Jim. Thanks very much for being there today. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. I'm not sure where I'll be, but likely still on in New Zealand. I hope Special K is out there, maybe hearing today. I hope you're okay, sweetheart, Miss K out there. And thanks. BBS Radio, thanks Don and the people there. Keep supporting Ron Paul out there. He's the hope of America. Mike Gravel, Kucinich, other good patriots out there. Keep up the good fight. Send our prayers out to America and the peoples of the world. Let's change the world. Let's help bring about a new world. We need a new world by the year 2012. This is Christopher Holmes, Zero Point. Visit my website, zeropoint.ca. Thanks, BBS, and this is me signing out. Thank you.